The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, good evening. It's very nice to be here. I'm not really a Philadelphian, but I did do a postgraduate degree at Penn, actually in the bicentennial year. And I have a memory, just reminding myself of the publicist, the Norton publicist, of the day of the bicentennial itself. There was some field not far from here, quite near Independence Hall, and there was on the platform, some of you may remember this, on the platform celebrating the bicentennial was Gerald Ford, the president, Mayor Rizzo, it's going back a bit, and to read the declaration in celebration, Charlton Heston, that well-known liberal. That's my memory of Philadelphia. It was a very happy year, so it's very nice to be back, and thank you all for coming. So I'll talk for a little bit, and then we'll have a Q&A, and then that'll be it, I guess. So what is Globish? Frankly, you're all in the same boat as the young novice who, after a sheltered life in the convent, takes a trip to the local town, a place of ill repute. As her bus approaches the town centre, she sees a bunch of women hanging around a sign, an advertisement for a number of things she does not really understand. At the top of the tariff, the words, Quickie, $25. Somewhat mystified, our novice enjoys an instructive day in town and returns to the convent at nightfall, where she's met by the Mother Superior, who asks how it went. A young novice reports a day full of interest. But, yes, dear, asks the Mother Superior. What's a quickie? The Mother Superior does not miss a beat. Same as in town, dear. $25. Quick is part of the founding vocabulary of English. It's an Anglo-Saxon word, which is spelled in Anglo-Saxon, quick, C-W-Y-C, and it's at least 1,000 years old. And for quick, my Penguin Dictionary gives three definitions, and the third is archaic, alive, as in the quick and the dead. In the Oxford English Dictionary, you'll find that what's become archaic is actually the original meaning, living, endowed with life, as in quick with child. And in the OED, it's not until you get to the 13th definition of quick that you find of the eye, ear, keen, or rapid in function. And my edition of the Oxford English Dictionary does not, alas, define quickie. Penguin does, of course. Something done or made in a hurry. This very short history of quick illustrates the very deep roots of English and also its great qualities. It's robust, adaptable, simple, and finally downright useful. Words, of course, colour our world. And part of what I want to argue briefly tonight is that English words used globally, globish, can affect how we think and how those who use them perceive the world. The history of globish is the opposite of quick, but it's topical and it's contemporary, and it begins with globalisation, a word that first slipped into its current usage during the 1980s. And I think the globalization of Anglo-American literature, language, and law is probably the cultural revolution of my generation. This paradigm shift, unprecedented in 500 years, will eventually come to be seen, I think, as a golden age. At the moment, it sponsors only confusion and uncertainty. But it's an item of breaking cultural news I have followed since I wrote the TV script from the book for The Story of English. I was horrified to realize 25 years ago in 1985. A generation back, my collaborators and I believed that we were taking a snapshot of the English language at its peak. In those days, some experts were saying that English might break up, like Latin, into mutually unintelligible variants. Perhaps the story of English would be a last hurrah. We were, of course, dead wrong. Once the Cold War ended, the global power of English began to hit another new high. And today, English is used in some form by about 4 billion people. That's two-thirds of the planet, a truly astonishing figure. As a mother tongue, it is outnumbered only by the nearly 1.8 billion speakers of Chinese. But it's worth noting that if the population of the USA is just over 300 million, some 350 million Chinese also speak English, some kind of English, or are learning it. And I'm defining this phenomenon as globish for one very good reason. Roughly since the millennium, English worldwide has moved into a new phase powered by global capitalism and the internet. Never before has there been such a hunger for this lingua franca. Never before has it had such a global reach. And I believe I'm describing something which I'm sure you're all familiar with if you travel, if you go to an airport or a foreign restaurant or bar or hotel. And what this unprecedented situation is something that for the first time in human history one would say it's possible for one language to be transmitted and received across the entire planet. You could make a broadcast from Philadelphia, which could be transmitted to Asia, Africa, Latin America, and there'd be a chance that somebody in whatever remote part was receiving that communication would be able to understand it. I've, in a way, been writing this book in my head for the past 25 years. 5 years ago, I found myself asking myself a series of questions about the redefinition of this lingua franca. What had it become? How and why did it happen? And today, really, very briefly, I'm just going to take you on the journey that I took to write the book. I went to Beijing. Every Friday evening, in universities across modern China, hundreds of students gather informally to hold what they call English conversation. Chatting in groups, a bit self-conscious, they talk about soccer, movies, and celebrities. They also learn something called crazy English, gathering in football stadiums to have basic English drilled into them by language teachers with megaphones and bullhorns. It's an absolutely bizarre scene. You see a stadium full of Chinese. The coach stands in the middle with his megaphone and repeats the opening, "Good morning, class." And they all reply, "Good morning, sir," it's backwards and forwards by rote. It's very strange. But this is just the most dramatic example of a global hunger for English that has, I'm arguing, brought English to a point of no return. And for me, one vital milestone was passed or occurred in 2005 with a riot. In September that year, the Jutland Post, a Danish magazine, published some cartoons, you probably remember this, poking fun at the Prophet Muhammad. The Muslim community was incensed. There were worldwide demonstrations, and more than 130 people were killed. But the most bizarre response to this affair was a protest by Muslim fundamentalists outside the Danish embassy in London. And this was the point at which this book begins for me. Chanting in English, the protesters carried placards with slogans like, "Freedom of expression, go to hell," "Behead the infidel," and my favourite, "Down with free speech." This collision of the Quran with Monty Python was my eureka moment. What more surreal and telling commentary on global English could there be? A demonstration of devout Muslims on the streets of London, exploiting an old English freedom expressed in the English language to demand the end of the libertarian tradition that actually legitimized their protest. 2 years later, I read an article in the International Herald Tribune about a French IBM executive, Monsieur Jean-Paul Nerrière, who described international English as, I quote, "the worldwide dialect of the third millennium." More to my purpose, he also gave this dialect a name. Monsieur Nerrière had been posted to Japan in the 1990s. And there he'd made one simple but brilliant observation. In his meetings, he'd noticed that non-native English speakers of the Far East were communicating far better with, say, Korean or Japanese clients than their British or American counterparts, for whom English was the mother tongue. Standard English or American was all very well for Anglophone societies, but in the developing world there was a role for what he called decaffeinated English. This simpler version for non-native speakers, declared Nerrière, showed every sign of becoming a universal phenomenon, and in a moment of inspiration, he christened it globish. Nerrière's idea quickly caught on, and soon I was not the only one following the subject. The Times journalist, my friend Ben McIntyre, described how, waiting for a flight from Delhi, he had overheard a conversation between a UN Spanish peacekeeper and an Indian soldier. I quote, The Indians spoke no Spanish, writes McIntyre. The Spaniards spoke no Punjabi, yet they understood one another easily. The language they spoke was a highly simplified form of English without grammar or structure, but perfectly comprehensible to them and to me. Only now, he concluded, do I realize that they were speaking Globish, the newest and most widely spoken language in the world. I went to see Monsieur Nerrier in Paris. He turned out to be a delightful French technocrat and bon viveur. For Nerrier, Globish was a lingua franca, independent of Britain and the USA, that was coming into its own at the start of the 21st century. Now, to me, as the writer of The Story of English, this suggestion was highly significant. I knew from my work on the series that the British Empire and many dialects of its language had enjoyed a unique supremacy throughout the 19th century. Broadly speaking, its power and influence had passed to the Americans in the 20th century through the agency of two world wars. After that, during the Cold War, Anglo-American culture and values had become as much part of global consciousness as the internal combustion engine. But during those years, its scope as a global language was always limited by its troubled association with British imperialism from the 19th century and the Pax Americana. Suddenly, however, around the year 2000, all that seemed to be a thing of the past. Perhaps Nerrier was right. Perhaps there was a new cultural revolution at work, the emergence of English as a global communications phenomenon with a new momentum that gave it some independence from its Anglo-American origins. You could almost express the idea in a quasi-scientific formula. English plus Microsoft equals Globish. So that's the what of Globish, but how did this happen? Again, I must ask you to go back 1,000 years and more to Anglo-Saxon England, where the core of Globish was forged. Forged through a succession of violent crises between the reigns of two famous English kings, Alfred the Great, approximately 900 AD, and Henry V, approximately 1400 AD, Shakespeare's Prince Hal. Old English, or Alfred's English, Anglo-Saxon, is not Globish, but its vocabulary is its cornerstone. All the basic building blocks, words like thee, is, you, and so on, are Anglo-Saxon, and you cannot write a simple English sentence today without using Anglo-Saxon vocabulary. And some Old English words, words like man and hus, hardly need translation. And it has a tremendous charge, rhetorically. In 1940, Anglo-Saxon, in 1940, when Winston Churchill wanted to appeal to the hearts and minds of the English-speaking people, he did it with the plain banners for which Old English is renowned. And this is a famous speech which I'll read a little bit of. Some of you may remember the radio version of it. We shall not fight or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. Only the last word, surrender, is Norman French. Everything else is Anglo-Saxon. It's very powerful. It's a series of hammer blows. But it's not old. Old English is not Churchill's English, but the influence lingers. And it's still being used today. In the last US election, the slogans of Barack Obama, slogans like Yes, We Can and Change We Can Believe In, helped, I believe, to universalize his appeal. And you could say that Obama himself, with childhood roots in Kenya, Kansas, Hawaii, and Indonesia, is a Globish president. And indeed, Monsieur Nerrier took Obama's first inaugural address and tried to translate it into simple English, and couldn't, and essentially failed because it was already in a very simplified, although quite expressing quite complicated thoughts. The vocabulary is very straightforward. Like Obama, English has a chameleon quality. It is flexible, adaptable, and pragmatic. It is also a great survivor. After Alfred, through compromise and intermarriage, it survived what I've described in this book as the mother of all invasions. When the Normans landed in 1066, there was a moment when English faced annihilation. War is a Norman word. The conquest was cruel and comprehensive. Words like fortress, siege, assault, and prison, all Norman French, tell their own story. The court and the church were purged of the Anglo-Saxons. The English and their language went into hiding. and English in the 11th century was confined to the islands of the UK, but it still had the quality it has today. It was the language of every man and every woman. Barely 100 years after the conquest, one chronicler wrote, I quote, that it is impossible to tell who is English and who is of Norman race. This is hardly surprising. I mean, consider the case of a Norman knight, a young man who had come over with William, fought at Hastings and been rewarded with property in the English countryside. Let's imagine he's married an English wife. He lives in his manor house or perhaps a small castle deep in the Shires. Surrounded by English peasants, served at table by English maids, his estates managed by an English steward. If he had children, our Norman knight would, his children would speak French to their parents, but English in play with other English children. At the very least, these Norman kids would be bilingual. Any Norman who'd come over with William, who wanted to prosper in England, would have to pick up some English to conduct business and overcome the resentment of his feudal subjects. And in the long run, the mixing of English and French would make the language richer and stronger, but in the short term, it made it more complex. 10,000 new words approximately came from France, 75% of which survive to this day. Words like allegiance, serf, and banquet, and fancy words for haute cuisine, words like veal. That's all with hindsight. Going by the written record, Latin and French flourish, and English appears to fade. About 100 years after the conquest, the English monks, who wrote the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, abandoned their work forever, and a great silence appears to descend on English prose. But below the radar, the language was alive and well, and the DNA of self-expression, which is part of the English character, ensured that the English survived. Off the page, the oral culture, which has carried through to the present, in my judgment, informal, demotic, vigorous, and profane, became the focus of national pride. In language, there was a three-way split. French became the smart, and Latin the professional, and English the popular language. English was direct, earthy, and simple. Words like fire, work, love, strong, heart. And those four-letter words that I cannot repeat here today come from Old English. French words were courtly and remote, glory, cordial, fortune, guile, and Latin sponsored an even more elevated vocabulary, exit for go, ascend for get up, regal for kingly, and so on. And English was the way to speak to the common people. By the reign of Henry V, at the beginning of the 15th century, the surest way to involve the people in a war against the French was to follow Alfred the Great and mobilize the English language. Henry V understood the propaganda value of the mother tongue. He sent his dispatches from Agincourt and Harfleur back home in English, and he used the vernacular in all his official documents. The elites who operated in government and the church became hopelessly isolated from ordinary people in everyday life, and their separation at this time has a long afterlife. And there's a very interesting moment in The Winter's Tale when Shakespeare brings the light finger, the thief, Autolycus, into the company of an uneducated shepherd. Autolycus turns to the shepherd and says, after a dispute, what advocate hast thou? Well, the shepherd doesn't know what advocate means, but there's a clown next to him, and the clown takes the shepherd aside and gives him some advice. And the clown says, advocate's the court word for a pheasant. Say you have none. So the shepherd turns to Autolycus, says, sir, I have no pheasant, cock, or hen. So it's a wonderful comic moment. Whereupon Autolycus turns to the audience and says, how blessed are we that are not simple men. But the truth is that English was being spread among simple men and women by the Protestant Revolution, by Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer and the King James Bible. It was also blessed by the appearance of a genius, William Shakespeare. Shakespeare married the Old English and Anglo-Norman traditions in a thrilling weave of poetry and storytelling. In Macbeth, for instance, Macbeth's lament after the murder of Duncan is a brilliant distillation of several centuries' linguistic innovation. I'm sure you will remember this passage from Macbeth's famous speech after the murder. And he holds up his hands and he says, "Will all great Neptune's ocean wash this blood clean from my hand? No, this my hand will rather the multitudinous seas incarnadine, making the green one red." What Shakespeare is doing here is really summarizing what I've been describing. He flatters the educated people who are sitting on the side of the stage, the gentlemen in the best seats, with a very flashy Latin phrase, "the multitudinous seas incarnadine," and then repeats it in plain good old English, "making the green one red," for the benefit of the pit. And I could quote many, many Shakespeare lines which are, well, not exactly glibish, but they celebrate the simplicity of the language. One which strikes me, which is immensely powerful, is Iago's exit line in Othello, when he's surrounded by his accusers. He turns to these accusers in a very brutal way and says, "Demand me nothing. What you know, you know. From this time forth, I never will speak word." And it's a very simple, it's Anglo-Saxon, it's very straightforward. The how of Glaubish is its secret weapon, and its capacity to endure endless simplification and to convey its meaning in the most abbreviated form. That's its secret weapon. But when we come to the when of the subject, the really important turning point occurs at the beginning of the 17th century. The self-confidence of Shakespeare's English was strictly local. The language of Shakespeare and the King James Bible would mean very little today, but for one thing. The self-confidence that inspired England's writers also drove ambitious young Englishmen abroad to explore and get rich. Money and fame were the keys that opened the door into the new world. In 1607, the year after Macbeth and King Lear, the first settlers made landfall in the new world, and they were followed by the Pilgrim Fathers of the Mayflower, who, when they came here, made one extraordinary discovery. Astonishingly, when these first colonists met with Native Americans, they discovered that these Native Americans were already speaking a kind of broken English. This is explained by William Bradford, the historian of the Plymouth Plantation, who writes, I quote, "The Pilgrim Fathers understood by discourse with one native that he belonged to the eastern parts, where some English ships had come to fish, amongst whom he had got his language." This is a perfect description of the making of Glaubish: contagious, adaptable, populist, and highly functional amongst ordinary people. There was, of course, a downside. Shakespeare again realized this in The Tempest when he created the slave Caliban. "You taught me language," Caliban rants at Prospero, "and my profit on it is I know how to curse." English, empire, and exploitation went hand in hand. By the 1770s, when the American colonists were ready to throw off the oppression of British rule, they declared linguistic independence right here in Philadelphia in American English, an aggressive new variety. That brilliant propagandist came up with the phrase, Tom Paine came up with the phrase, "the United States of America." Thomas Jefferson proclaimed the value of what he called judicious neologism. A man who designed his own house and writing desk also loved to invent new words. Some of his inventions include words like belittle, antagonize, and seaboard. He was teased for these words. I mean, logically, if you've thrown off the yoke of British oppression, you might want to turn to another language. But the founding fathers, I suppose de facto, they felt that they had to simply remake it, and indeed always rather rhetorically referred to it as the American language. John Adams, Jefferson's rival, predicted in a burst of patriotism that the American population will produce a greater number of peoples who will speak English than any other language. The English were not overjoyed at the vogue for American. Dr. Johnson declared that this latest dialect, as he called it, was a tract of corruption to which every language, widely diffused, must always be exposed. And everyone who considers the concept of Glaubish is bound to follow Johnson in some sense, suggest that it might be a corruption. Others of Johnson of the period made fun of the neologisms of the American Revolution, words like dollar, cent, presidential, bookstore, and placate. For the coming 19th century, British English would be the dominant and imperial, even imperious expression of the language, but it had not forgotten its common roots. Unlike the French, it was not imparted top-down through the academy and the grandes écoles, but bubbled up from below on the lips of ordinary people in everyday situations. Walt Whitman, the great American poet, celebrated this democratic populist character. He wrote in the preface to The Leaves of Grass, I quote, a powerful statement, "The English language is not an abstract construction of the dictionary makers. It is the powerful language of resistance. It is the dialect of common sense. It is the speech of all who aspire, and it has its basis, broad and low, close to the ground." It would be rash, I think, to justify or claim the Empire as an agent for linguistic innovation, but there is no doubt that this peculiar evolution, part war, part trade, part mission, was extremely hospitable to the spread of the language. The former colonial Englishes of India, Africa, Australia and New Zealand contributed another element to Globish. Australian English, for example, with its vigorous slang, is always popular, and some of its humour like as scarce as rocking horse manure or hanging about like a fart in a phone box, stemmed directly from the Middle Age, and all Middle Ages would have delighted Chaucer. Sometimes it's impossible to distinguish between real and invented Australianisms. The comedian Barry Humphreys told me he'd made up quite a few. But life will always go one better than art. Sitting in the back of a bus, Humphreys heard one woman describe her hysterectomy to a friend. She said that she'd had, as she put it, a hizzy in the hozzy. By 1870, Britain and America were, economically speaking, equal. But the Queen's English, British English, was infinitely still more international. But with the outbreak of the First World War, the balance of power began to shift. In the summer of 1914, the common language and culture of Europe was German or French. Paris and Berlin were capitals of the arts and sciences. But by 1919, Europe had begun an anglicising process that runs up to and beyond World War II. The arrival of the Doughboys in France and Woodrow Wilson in Paris gave English an accent, a vocabulary, and more importantly, a momentum that was American. Virginia Woolf wrote at the time, "The Americans are doing what the Elizabethans did. They are coining new words. In England, the word coining power has lapsed." The Second World War reinforced this trend. Movies, international magazines, consumer goods, advertising. American culture was everywhere. But the decisive moment for Globish in the 20th century occurred after the war, for the making of Globish, occurred after the war was over, and it was performed by a British politician of Anglo-American descent. In 1947, Winston Churchill, who features quite a bit in this book, I must say, gave a speech in Fulton, Missouri, and the speech is famous for the soundbite, "From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent." But just as important, and almost unnoticed, in the same speech, Churchill called on, I quote, "the fraternal associations of the English-speaking peoples" to create what he called a special relationship between the British Commonwealth, the Empire, and the United States. From 1947 to 1989 and the end of the Cold War, versions of this special relationship divided the world into capitalist, progressive, Anglophone societies opposed to the threat of totalitarian communism. Until the collapse of the Soviet Union, English was associated with empire and then with the cultural imperialism of the Pax Americana. But then, in the 1990s, something happened. From 1989 to the present, roughly 20 years, there has been a generation in which English became propelled on a new global trajectory by global capitalism and the internet, two very powerful forces. Which brings me to the why of Globish. I've suggested that it articulates a longing for self-expression, as in the phrase, "down with free speech." Words, as I've said, affect how we see the world. Globish helps liberate markets, democratize politics, and simplify communication. Just like Latin in the Middle Ages, there was now a need in the 1990s for a lingua franca that could function efficiently on a global platform. This was what Monsieur Neria had witnessed in Japan, the beginnings of a sea change, which is going on as we speak and will continue to go on, I suspect, for many, many years. But despite Globish, the world is still a crazy patchwork of some 5,000 languages reflecting many petty nationalisms, which excite tremendous local loyalties. I mean, there was an article in the Times only two days ago, which I cut out. I was coming here, which is an account of the attempts of the Estonians to sustain Estonian against the threat of globish and also of the afterglow of the Russian supremacy. And basically, the Estonians have established a language police to raise the level of Estonian in Estonia. And I think they're right to do that. I mean, it's very important to have local cultures. But what I'm saying is that when these break down, when communication breaks down under the pressure for global interaction in, say, the recent banking crisis or the Iranian election, then globish, the world English, becomes the default position when mother tongues fail. It is not a dialect in the traditional sense, but it is a means of communication, contagious, adaptable, populist or popular, and sometimes even subversive. And it now has a life of its own. Its momentum, for the first time, no longer really depends on British or American power. Globish has a supranational momentum, and it's what the world turns to get its message across, in Greece, in Iran, in Georgia, even at the World Cup, which has a global anthem, globish anthem, written by a Somalian of Canadian descent in globish. There are many other, I could give you hundreds of examples, and there are just a few that stick out, and I'm sure you have your own examples of this. But in 2004, both Chile and Mongolia declared their intention to become bilingual in English. In 2006, English was added to the Mexican primary school curriculum as a compulsory second language. Singapore, for example, is now firmly committed to an English first policy after decades of linguistic experimentation with Mandarin Chinese. Singapore's Prime Minister expressed the logic of this policy in a speech in 2005. I quote, I believe we should all make the effort, he said, and consciously speak good English at home, at work, or in social gatherings. Then he uttered what I think of it as a supremely globish sentiment. Speaking good English does not mean using bombastic words or adopting an artificial English or American accent. We can speak in the normal Singapore tone, which is neutral and intelligible. Neutral and intelligible is a precise description of globish in the year 2010. I can give you one or two more examples, and I'm sure you have others from your own experience. For example, in 2009, the formerly Francophone state of Rwanda not only adopted English as its official language of international communication, but also applied to join the British Commonwealth, following the example of Mozambique and Algeria. When challenged about this decision, Rwanda's trade minister replied, French is only spoken in France, some parts of West Africa, parts of Canada, and Switzerland. Enough said. Globish also popped up at the G20 summit in London in April last year. The Czech Prime Minister, I think he may no longer be the Czech Prime Minister, he was called Mirek Topolánek. He got into a row with his fellow summiteers when he dismissed US and UK spending plans as, I quote, the road to hell. There was a diplomatic incident, and the Czech PM gave a bizarre explanation for his choice of words for his attack on America. The night before, he said he'd been listening to Meatloaf's song, Bat Out of Hell. And I must share with you, I love the New York Times' obsession with honorifics. They always refer, well, they didn't always, but they did on this occasion refer to Meatloaf as Mr. Loaf. There were many corrections following that one. How useful is all this? Well, it can be a lifesaver. So Eric Anderson, a famous or distinguished English educationist, tells me a true story that underlines the life and death significance of globish. On the morning of the 7/7 bombings in London, an Arab exchange student at the foundation run by Anderson tried to take a tube train from southwest London to his class in the city. When the boy found the station inexplicably closed, the underground had been shut after the first bomb had gone off, he boarded a double-decker bus. He was one of a handful on board, paying no attention to his fellow travellers, when his cell phone rang. It was a Greek friend calling from Athens, where the news of the bombings was playing on CNN. The Arab boy's Greek friend described this breaking news in globish. London's buses, he said, had become a terrorist target. As a result of this globish conversation, the student, Arab student, hopped off the bus to look for another route to class, walked down the street, and as he walked down the street, the bus blew up, killing and injuring all on board. If I may anticipate one obvious line of questioning, this is not the end of Babel. We say Babel, I think you say Babel. The end of Babel. It is not the end of anything, but more likely a beginning. The world may be flatter and smaller than ever before, and native speakers will always cling to their mother tongue, as they always have and always should. But when an Indian and a Cuban want to commission research from a lab in Uruguay with additional input from Israeli technicians, as a Midwest startup recently did, the language they turn to will be globish. And year on year, into the near future, it's something I think we should all understand and appreciate more and more. Culture is, of course, about identity. For as long as people wish to express themselves in terms of ideas like freedom, individuality, and originality, and so forth, and for as long as there are schoolchildren who are versed in Shakespeare, The Simpsons, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bible, globish will remain the means by which an educated minority of the planet communicates in the quest for a better world. Thank you very much. And now I'm sure that you probably want to take issue with many things I've said, and questions. And there are roving mics. There's one here. I think there's probably one on either side. So I think the drill is you put your hand up. I didn't identify. You say yes.
If the Chinese outnumber us, why, let's say 500 years from now, won't we be speaking Chinese?
Mandarin.
Or Mandarin.
It's funny how this comes up. This is a line of questioning which comes up a lot. The answer is, indeed, why not? But I think it's unlikely. Certainly on the evidence of my visits to China and my observation. Also, I don't speak or read Mandarin. But it seems there's something about Chinese culture which seems to be quite self-sufficient and quite internalized. It seems to show no desire, unlike, say, English, to communicate with the wider world. I mean, if you recall the recent controversy with Google, the Chinese response was to have nothing to do with it, not to engage, and to close off. And that's not a society which is likely to be spreading its language around the world. But anything could happen. And as the story I've described is the story of the spread of language through empire, through trade, and through money. So, I couldn't rule it out. Also, I think currently, at any rate, you've got the Chinese middle class desperate to acquire globish. You see them all wanting, because they want to come to America or come to the West to go to university. And they're throwing off their Chinese heritage. There's a kind of rush towards the English, Anglo-American tradition. And at the same time, I think one has to say that China is, in many ways, the Chinese peasant is barely literate, barely has a grasp of his own language, let alone English. And there are millions and millions of peasants away from. And the phenomenon I described of crazy English is really a city phenomenon. And I think, for all these different reasons, I think the likelihood of what you're suggesting is probably pretty remote. But you never know.
I want to make a statement and ask a question. My wife and I have taught in China in September of every year for a couple of years now. We're through a group out of Tucson, Arizona, which is a national group called Teach for Friendship. It's a nonprofit, non-governmental, non-religious group, and it's very good. Anyway, my point was that in saying that is that the reason that we're teaching in Wuhan is because the fact that the universities evidently in China have said, and these are the best of the best students, I mean, they've tested all the way up, the universities have said to them they must learn conversational English, which is what we teach. And so the question was that we asked them was, why is your government doing this? And their answer was that because we will best you in economics, science, and so on, and we need to learn how to speak that. My question is, do you feel this is happening in other, I know you said other countries have globish, but do you feel that this kind of top-down orders have gone to other countries?
I mean, some example, I mean, I've mentioned Rwanda, I mean, but on the whole, not. And again, should have been part of my answer to the first question. I mean, China, like France, it's always very top-down. It's always the academy and the government who dictates what should happen. English has always been bottom-up. And I think, on the whole, top-down is not a good way is not a promising way for language change to occur. Because on the whole, people think about languages. We're all experts. We all have a mother tongue. We want it to be ours. We don't want it to be given to us by a civil servant or a government official. And a language which is responsive to that instinct is going to do better than a language which is handed down on stone tablets, so to speak, from on high. So I think that's the crucial difference. Question there.
Yes. In a lot of what you were talking about with English and the relationship with other languages, I was just reading in a book, I can't think of the name of it, but they were by the authors of 60 Million Frenchmen Can't Be Wrong. And I'm just wondering, they were saying that there's been a movement afoot in the world with the Francophone countries, you know, Francophone countries to counterbalance English and the mindset of being dominant on the world stage. And as a counterbalance, you know, they've been fostering French, you know, in the African countries and in other places. And also as a means of language preservation. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts were on that. You know, I mean, I understand, you know, English is how English became the world dominant language. But you think other languages will survive in terms of French or that kind of thing? I mean, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are in terms of...
Well, I can answer a bit by talking about the European Union, which was set up in the 1950s. When it was set up as a bilingual... twin track, English and French, because in those days, of course, French was the language of diplomacy. And all the documentation which came out of Brussels was in English and French and had to be by statute. And all the diplomats who went into the European Union, European community, had to be at least bilingual. And that's completely gone in the last 10 years. I mean, they continue to produce the just churn out all this paper in two languages, but it's the recent accession, so-called accession states to the European Union, the countries of the former Soviet Union from the former Eastern Bloc, have embraced what I call globish on a colossal scale. And if you go to Brussels now, you hear that spoken far more than anything else. And if you're a non-English speaker, if you don't have access to this language, you are you're a second-class citizen within the EU, certainly at the official level. Of course, French is being sustained by the academy and by government programs. Every 4 or 5 years, they produce another set of French vocabulary to take on the borrowings from the English language, which is always the subject of a newspaper article, which probably written by me. probably making fun of all this, but I mean, in the last 30 years, I can think of at least 3 occasions when one president or another has tried to promote French by insisting on the use of certain words. But there's a high degree of hypocrisy here because, I mean, for example, Chirac always spoke French to the media, but was actually very well versed in American and understood everything. Yes.
I was wondering, we haven't spoken about Spanish. I understand that in the United States, they talk about by the year 2050, half of the United States will be speaking Spanish. Mm. So I'd like to know your thoughts on that. And then my other question would be, so do you think of us who speak English, should we just, how do you say, like sleep on the laurels and just forget about learning any other languages, maintain ourselves as monolingual, or should
we? Can I take the second part first? Because I think that's actually interesting. I think, you know, we are in some ways, we are the losers in all this, in that we're now more monolingual, or our children are, than we were. 30 years ago, you would have to learn French. When I grew up, I had to learn French and German and all kinds of things. And now, there's no pressure of any kind to do anything other than master that basic standard. And I think that's there's a loss there, cultural loss, no question. I don't know, honestly, to stand here and hold forth about the Hispanic question in front of you guys would be preposterous. I have no idea. All I can say is that Jefferson did write about this many, many years ago. In one of the one of those letters with Madison, he addressed the Spanish question. So he was aware of it. It's been around for a long time. I suspect, it's one of those things which can seem like a threat or a potentiality, which might be less alarming when it actually turns out. The thing about language is that it's often a lightning conductor. It's used by ordinary people, all kinds of people, as a lightning conductor for social anxiety. So you might have a fear about the rise of the Hispanics, or the rise of Hispanic society, or the power of the Hispanic society within America, but you would attach that fear to a language point rather than to a social point. That's my only observation on that. But I have no idea and there's a question there. Come to you in a minute, sir.
Question about the simplification process in Globish, as you describe it. Simplified grammar, simplified syntax, simplified vocabulary. Now, anyone who uses English as a native language is aware of the fact that what you put in an email, you have to phrase it.
Mm.
And English is not that easy a language because there are all these nuances.
Mm.
If you write the email wrong, first of all, you'll lose effectiveness.
Mm.
Sometimes it's even a question of power. You will not get the answer that you are expecting, hoping for. You know what I mean when you phrase the actual letter or email.
Mm.
Is there a danger, therefore, in using, in most of the world, using Globish, in losing effectiveness and using a language which they're not really mastering? Mm. They're stumbling around with it instead of really, you know, carefully using it.
It's certainly a risk, and I think you're right to point it out. Nerea, who coined the term, he and I diverge on this point. He's now produced a handbook called Parler Globish, ironically, because he's French, which has a core vocabulary of 1,500 words, which is the same as actually Voice of America, very similar. And this ambition to create a basic core is one which goes back. I mean, it's been around for about 100 years. I personally don't really have much time for it. I think it's an interesting sidelight, but it's not the core. What I'm trying to describe is something which is sort of more metaphorical. The idea that it should be everyone's second language. But I think the point you raise is a very good one, and that we might be creating sort of two tiers, at least two, in a kind of an underclass of people who are not fully equipped to negotiate the complexity of things. That's a very good point. I think I rather agree with that, actually. Yeah.
I was surprised maybe a year or so ago to learn that Microsoft was abandoning its encyclopedia because they can't keep up with Wikipedia. Wikipedia is more current, it has more subjects and things like that. So you didn't mention that, but it would seem to be another factor, because when you read Wikipedia articles or you read about how they're running this organization, you realize anybody anywhere can be contributing to the articles or modifying them or something. Mm. So those people also would want to learn English because they would want to, whatever there was their field of expertise, they'd want to correct articles or write an article or something like this. Mm. English would be the way they draft their first contribution.
Mm.
And then it would be translated into other languages by other people that participate by doing that. So we have that also as a factor, I think, for sharing English.
Absolutely. Now, I mean, this is a sketch. I mean, this is a giant picture, and there are bits, lots of bits need to be coloured in, so to speak. I've just done a sketch it's the outline of an idea, which people, as it were, anyone can add their own bits to, and from their own experience. It doesn't claim to be comprehensive. It's a short book. I deliberately kept it short, and it's not designed to be comprehensive. It couldn't possibly be. Wouldn't have time to research it all. And I think not a day passes without something in the papers cropping up, which, as it were, develops the point or maybe contradicts it. But that's part of the dialectic, in my view. So, yes, sir. And there's a question over there. We'll come to you in a minute, ma'am.
With English, dialect and accent are often a reflection of class mm-hmm. or education. Mm-hmm. Does Globish begin to become an equalizer?
I think it does, yes. I think that's right. Because, I mean, in the sense that if you hear a Korean speak Globish, he or she might attempt an American... I mean, there is a divergence here. In the Far East particularly, there's preference in certain language schools for British English, which they think is sort of posher, superior. towards American, which is more seen as more useful. But both of those versions are a kind of parody of the way we speak. I don't think, if you listen to a Korean speaking, he might think he's using American English, but sure as hell he's not. I don't think there's going to be a great range of, I think there will be a kind of international standard of Globish. And the accents are a delightful throwback, but I don't think they're more than that, really. And in this country, of course, there's a very rich variety of them. One more. There's one, the lady in green.
Since this is the last question, I first want to thank you for a wonderful presentation on a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I work on English language tests. And our business is just booming because there is an incredible demand, and it's going out into all sorts of different formats, including cell phones, et cetera.
Mm, mm.
But my question really is not so much about the global component, because I'm familiar with that, but I wanted your take on the simplification within native English-speaking countries in which young people are texting and what effect that's having on actually reducing the sophistication of the language.
I'm sure that's true. I think I should also very interesting. Thank you for your comment. The case that you cite seems to me gives me encourages me to think that I'm sort of onto something about this step change that's occurred in the last 20 years. Texting, I think, of course, is going to be redundant quite soon. Once voice recognition comes in, texting will probably disappear, and so it's a phase. Is that right? I believe that texting is going to be replaced by voice recognition. I think that historically there have always been moments in the evolution of the language where people have been. I mean, Jonathan Swift wrote a brilliant essay, as you probably remember, in the beginning of the 18th century, denouncing the simplifications of the younger generation. And it reads like somebody's complaining about texting. It's curiously unchanged. I'm not too fussed by this. It seems to me that there's such resilience in the language and resilience in self-expression that, I mean, LOL and OMG and all the rest of it, it's a delightful addition, but it doesn't mean the end of civilization. Although others might disagree with this. Well, maybe one more question? Yes. Voice recognition. The power of a computer to hear your voice. I mean, it's not doing too well at the moment, but it's going to come, obviously. And I think the other point I'd like to make in conclusion is that electronic time is faster than real time. The changes that are going on in the IT revolution are taking place at an incredible speed and making changes which are bound to have consequences we cannot really fathom. And you know, we're, as I described it, as a paradigm shift. We're in the middle of this paradigm shift. We're right in the middle of it. And anyone who says they know where it's going has to be lying. I mean, we don't. We're in this very strange situation where we just do not know the outcome of all this change. But it's quite thrilling, and I think it's one to which English is well adapted, because it always has been adaptable, as I tried to indicate from my talk. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.